This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Anthony Scoma. Today on the program, a panel of experts look at the worsening fire conditions in the western U.S. and discuss the efforts to mitigate wildfires in the region. This summer, the Wasatch Front saw some of the worst air quality in the world due to smoke from both in- and out-of-state fires. Northern California's Dixie Fire burned nearly 1 million acres, 1,300 structures, and cost more than $500 million to combat. Thousands of Utahns were also forced to evacuate their homes as unprecedented drought conditions and heat fueled a fire near Park City. Today's panel discusses the environmental, societal, and economic realities of these wildfires and how the West must adapt to a warming climate. The panel includes Andrea Brunel, Chair of the Geography Department at the University of Utah, Brett Osler, State Fire Management Officer at the Utah Division of Forestry, Fire, and State Lands, Kim Frost, Executive Director of UCARE, and Mitchell Power, Associate Professor of Geography at the University of Utah. Moderating today's discussion is Brenda Bowen, Director of the Global Change and Sustainability Center and Co-Chair of the University of Utah Climate Task Force. This forum was put on in partnership with the University of Utah Office of Sustainability. This forum was recorded on September 1st, 2021. Here's your moderator, Brenda Bowen.
We're here today to have a conversation about something that is impacting so many right now, wildfires in the West. And we're seeing that the wildfires in the American West are increasing in both size and severity. This year, drought conditions amid this changing climate has really exacerbated wildfire danger. And so we're excited to talk to the group of people gathered here today about some of these issues. And so we'll start by asking each of our panelists, how do the wildfires of 2021 and in recent years compare to fires of 20 years ago, 50 years ago, or even further back? And what is driving that change? And Andrea, let's start with you.
Hi, Linda. Thank you for having me. So when we look at what's been going on in the last few years with fire, it's definitely out of the range of natural variability that we see when we look at long-term records, which is what Mitch and I both do. We study thousands of years of fire history. Even without those really long-term perspectives, I found something on the Forest Service website that said since 2015, fire season has gotten about 2.5 months longer than it was in the 70s. And the 9 largest wildfire seasons since reliable records began have occurred since 2005. So from a very long-term perspective and even a more recent perspective, we know that what we're seeing now is not normal. I pulled up the most recent IPCC report before we met today just to see, you know, what, if anything, they said about wildfire. And in the full Working Group 1 report, wildfire was mentioned 616 times, which kind of gives you an idea that there's a strong relationship between what we're seeing and climate change. And they attribute that to fire weather, which is warmer conditions, drier conditions, and windier conditions.
Great. Thanks. Mitch, let's pass it to you and hear your thoughts on this question about the what we're seeing now compared to historic records and what's driving that change.
Sure. Thanks. Thanks, Brenda. And thank you for the Hinckley Forum for this invitation. It's great to be on this panel. I would echo everything Andrea has just said. It's really to people like Andrea and I that study thousands of years of variability, when we see this most recent type of variability, it doesn't fit within what we often call the envelope of natural variability. And you know, there's a couple things going on as the big drivers, as we all know. Of course, you know, the temperature has been rising. And as the temperature rises across the West, we increase the evaporation rates. And as those evaporation rates increase, you can imagine our forests are essentially, they're like straws in the landscape. And they connect the soil moisture and the groundwater systems to the atmosphere. And that atmosphere is pulling more of that moisture out. And so this extreme drought, in fact, I think this drought we have right now, 19 years of drought, We haven't seen anything like this since probably the late 1500s. And the next extreme drought that's close to this is back around 800 AD. So we're really getting some of these unique events. And you know, as a scientist, I like to say it's exciting in one hand to get to see this unfold. But of course, as a citizen, it's concerning. So there's a lot of temperature rise that's driving some of the fuel conditions, which are then not only triggering wildfires, but it's a cascade of effects. And that's, you know, Andrew had mentioned the IPCC, and there's some great points made about wildfires, the IPCC report. And one of those is this idea of multiple extreme events happening simultaneously. And so you have droughts, you have insect infestations, and you have wildfires all commingling. And so these are kind of changing the rules across the West. And so, and I guess I just would end by saying, as a fire ecologist, we know fire is good, and the West evolved with fire, and we need more fire. So part of the equation is, you know, we've suppressed fire for a long time, and we want to bring it back, but how do you bring it back in a way that works for communities and works for not just people, but the flora and fauna? And so it's a really complex problem, and I'm curious to hear more from our panelists about this. Thanks.
Thanks. It's really interesting to think about those cascading effects and how they compound some of these challenges. Kim, let's go to you and hear your thoughts on this sort of recent fire season and what's going on.
Yeah, well, so thank you for having me. I'm Kim Frost, the executive director for UCARE, which is the Utah Clean Air Partnership. And so we really focus on air quality issues. And I think it's been very visible, obviously, to Utahns this year that we've had air quality issues due to wildfires. The thing that's challenging for us is that we also have a summer ozone issue that's happening simultaneously. And so we want citizens to be aware that while it is obviously related to the wildfires, and that's due to the warmer, drier summer that we've had, we also have this other issue going on, which is summer ozone. And it's really, our air quality issues are exacerbated by wildfires and summer ozone happening at the same time. So we've had more poor air quality days this summer than we have in, you know, any of our recent years.
Yeah, wow. And Brett, let's pass it to you.
Good afternoon, and thank you for this opportunity. As mentioned, my name is Brett Osler. I am the State Fire Management Officer for the Division of Forestry, Fire, and State Lands here in Utah. And I've been fighting fire in the West for 30 years. And in those 30 years, we have seen a significant amount of change. The biggest being, which, you know, no one wants to say it is, but it is climate change. The temperatures have been increasing, and those fire seasons have been getting longer. And we of agencies have not adapted to that. Typically, fire season is 6 months. We don't call it a fire season anymore. It's more of a fire year. And as mentioned, fire is good, but the way we have been seeing fire, and we call them mega fires, is not good. Because what we've done as a society is we've moved our homes into these areas that burn. And then, you know, we end up expending more costs to suppress those fires to save those structures. And so that's some of the biggest change that we've seen. The other is our workforce. We're burning our workforce out. They've not been designed to go year round. And that's something that we've got to change. We've got to have a workforce that adapts to these year round fire seasons so that we're not burning our folks out. And so, you know, those are some of the changes that we've seen as of late.
Wow. There's a lot to think about and discuss here. You know, you've touched on issues related to air quality. We can link to public health, management of forested lands and things, which shows all of these complex feedbacks and impacts of wildfire, both within the ecosystem and within society. So can you describe a bit both the direct and indirect impacts of wildfire on ecosystems? You know, what is it that fire brings to the ecosystem that's essential within that ecosystem? But then what are some of the major issues around air quality, public health, and tourism, sort of that ecological versus social impacts? And I'll ask which of the panelists would like to speak on this first, rather than calling on you this time, and let you indicate who's prepared to comment on this. Mitch, thanks.
Sure, I'll start us off here. Just from the ecosystem perspective, and so a lot of the work that we do in my lab is we look at recovery times. So we're really interested on these kind of direct, immediate effects. So you have mortality. You know, this is mostly an ecological perspective, leaving humans aside for a minute. You have a lot of mortality of the vegetation. A lot of the fauna in the area will be either killed or forced to move out. And so we look at, you know, how much time does it take to recolonize? And what's the sequence? What's the pattern of recolonization? And so you can imagine it in a very simple kind of conceptual model. When you burn a system, you have grasses come in first, and you have shrublands, and then eventually you'll have a forest return. And so we're very curious about that. And that's a natural, immediate process. And that's really great, because as you increase the patchiness of landscapes through something like fire, you increase the diversity of different flora and fauna species that can occupy it. So those are really net positive effects. But, you know, there's also some negatives, especially when you switch to the human side of the equation. And I'm sure Kim will talk more about this, but, you know, some of the health effects, there's lots of emissions that come out of fires. And Brett, I'm sure, is well versed on these, you know, the carbon monoxide and methane and CO2. And, you know, I've read some reports of concern for firefighters and the carbon monoxide exposure levels in certain blazes. And then when you move into the WUI, as Brett mentioned, you know, some of those direct effects of emissions from human-made materials can be really dangerous. And then there's really interesting emerging research on smoke itself and this concept of aging smoke. So as you imagine, our smoke moves across the country towards the eastern seaboard. Well, as you age smoke, it interacts with the atmosphere and sunlight, and it actually changes the chemistry of the smoke, and it can actually become more toxic. And so there's some interesting new work on those kind of direct effects too. So there's quite a bit in there of you know, the good for the ecosystem on small scales, but the kind of scale of fire, the intensity of these fires we're seeing, it's harder for that recovery process to happen, especially when you lose things like your seedbed. So those are just a few thoughts to get the panelists going here.
Great, thank you. Who would like to go next? Brett, let's hear from you.
Sorry, Kim. Some of the other things that we also see that is direct is damage to homes, structures, and private property. As mentioned, as the WUI continues to grow into these areas where, you know, we've let fires burn and now the forests have regrown back and now people want to move their homes into these areas. You know, one of the biggest impacts is the watershed. You know, when these fires go through there, we damage those watersheds. We've seen that in 2017 on the Bryan Head fire. Panguitch City had quite a bit of damage to their watershed. We worry about that on all of these fires that we have. And so we need to make sure that those watersheds stay intact, that we'll, you know, try to don't burn all that vegetation out. And if we do, you know, we're making sure that as we put fire on the ground to help control, that's one of the things that we're looking at when we develop a burn plan to extinguish this fire is what impact is it going to have to that watershed. And we know by doing that there's also those harmful smoke impacts that we see here in the West right now. And, you know, that smoke's not coming out of Utah, but we're seeing that and how it affects the neighboring states.
You both mentioned the WUI, just to spell that out for our our participants who might not know what we're referring to there, the wildland urban interface, right? So this place where our metropolitan areas are really pushing into and encroaching into more wilderness areas that are going to have different management and different compositions and structures. Kim, invite you to comment next.
Yeah, thank you. You know, related to air quality and how it impacts our air quality, there are obviously a lot of direct impacts, and that's healthcare. So we know that wildfires have some of the same health impacts that our summer ozone and winter inversion have. They have, you know, an effect on heart disease, respiratory infection, asthma. They really are, you know, PM2.5, as we talk about in the air quality world, where they're really fine particulate matters that get in our lungs and they have an impact on us. So, you know, direct impacts are healthcare and then lost earning potentials. And then indirect, when we talk about air quality, we do see a loss of tourism. One of the things that's been changing over the years is how tourism is impacted by social media, and we really get beat up in social media and in the news when we have these air quality issues. And then we see decreased growth. There's a regulatory burden of air quality and poor air quality issues, and then some business costs. And so as we look at it, it's not just directly related to wildfires, but we see that conservatively, we can estimate that there's about a $1.8 billion impact annually from air quality issues. And so again, that's not just wildfire, but as wildfires increase, we will see that number increase as well.
Wow, yeah, thinking about those economic impacts. Yes, Andrea, on to you.
I think the panel really covered, you know, a lot here. I think the only thing that I would say, which follows on Mitch's discussion about recovery of systems, is one of the things we're seeing with these fires is they don't behave like they might behave in an unaltered system. So systems that might tolerate, you know, ground fire, you know, every 5 to 10 years are now having high intensity, high mortality fires. And like Brett said, this can affect the watershed by creating hydrophobic soils. It can retard the recovery by, you know, destroying the seedbed, and also just by burning the organics out of the soils and rendering them, you know, more sterile when they started.
So as we think about how to move forward and how to prepare and how to respond, what can be done to reduce the number and severity of wildfires? And adding on to that, you know, what is the role of the state versus the federal government when it comes to prevention, mitigation, or response? So what can be done, and who needs to be the folks doing that? Andrea, let's start with you.
I'm sure Brett's going to have a much better answer for this, but, you know, I think the first thing is we have to deal with the, you know, the elephant in the room, right? Climate change. And we're not necessarily, even if we, you know, change our energy infrastructure today, we're not going to see, you know, things cooling off immediately. But that's certainly something that has to be addressed in the, you know, near to immediate future. You know, with what we're dealing with now and what we have to, you know, really address is how do we, you know, minimize the risk of wildfire, and how do we, you know, protect the folks that are out there fighting these fires. And I think in systems where it can be done, you know, doing some mechanical thinning and some prescribed burning so that when ignitions occur, it doesn't result in such intense fires. And I think the WUI is a big, big concern too, is I don't know if it's possible, but getting people away from that edge so that, you know, firefighters aren't putting themselves at risk trying to protect these structures that probably shouldn't be there in the first place.
Brett.
Thank you. One of the biggest things we can do, and we've done it this year, is reduce the number of human-caused fires. You know, last year, 94% of the fires in the state of Utah were human-caused. We've reduced that number significantly this year by our Fire Sense campaign and getting that message out. We'll never be able to prevent the lightning-caused fires. So the other thing that we're doing is major fuels reductions projects. And we do those interagency across all borders, large-scale scape. And you know, those are working, but, you know, by the time they grow back, it's just hard to maintain those. And so it's an ongoing effort through mitigation, but prevention is one of the biggest things that we're doing. And we do that with our interagency partners through our new campaign. And we see that it's working, and it's worked this year. It's something that we're going to continue.
Great. Would any of our other panelists like to comment again, Andrea?
I just had a question for Brett. I think that's fantastic that the program to reduce human-caused fires has been so successful. I had somebody ask me a couple weeks ago if they'll ever be able to have fireworks in Utah again, and I just wondered what your thoughts were on that.
Well, we had fireworks this year. We did not ban those in the incorporated areas, but we did have several municipalities, you know, because of some of the areas, they did restrict where you could shoot off fireworks. You know, I don't think you'll ever see an outright ban on fireworks, but you're definitely going to have areas where it's not encouraged to use fireworks. And definitely our public lands is not that area. You're going to see fireworks continue in your municipalities, but never outside of those areas.
Yeah, Kim.
I would just echo what Brett has said. We really focus on what individuals can do. And so usually during the summer months, we're talking about how individuals can reduce their emissions so that they can positively impact summer ozone. But this year, we've also been trying to message some of the same things that DNR has and talk about decreasing human-caused fires. And then also just more broadly, you know, drought reduction strategies and really slowing the flow. And so we really want individuals to be part of the solution. And we think that that has an impact.
So as we're thinking about things individuals can do to minimize their risk of being, you know, potentially a cause of a fire, also seems like an opportunity to talk about both individual and integrated partnering across agencies around climate change and some of the things that we're thinking about that are driving some of these big changes that we're experiencing right now. Are there other things we might put out there if we're thinking about what can be done? What messaging might we want to share with the community right now about, you know, both the elephant in the room, our climate impacts, as well as, you know, these, how if our friends and neighbors are saying, what can I do to help not have these fires happening? What advice would you give them? Yeah, Brett.
Well, I'll hold off on the advice. I did see a message come up that talked about prescribed fire. We try to do as much prescribed fire as we can. But then when we do that, we are sending a lot of that smoke up in the air, and it does impact, you know, health again. And, you know, we've tried to reduce the amount of prescribed fire we do and try to do as much mechanical treatment as we can. You'll never see us get completely rid of prescribed burn. We will do that when and where we can, but it's really limited on how much smoke that we put in the air and what impacts that it has on the communities that surround those areas. And so, you know, the question was, do we do prescribed burn in Utah? Yes, all agencies do. Some are bigger than others, but we try to do that in the appropriate way.
Great, thanks. Any other comments on the prescribed fire discussion, Mitch?
Sure, I just wanted to add a bit to Kim's point on the kind of education campaign that we really need to do. And there's a lot of great resources out there. You know, smokybear.org, Firewise, you know, you can go online and you can find tremendous resources if you're a homeowner and the things you can do right around your own home that can help firefighters kind of minimize the amount of work that they'll have to do when a fire hits a WUI area. There's also some really interesting work being done in the National Cohesive Wildland Fire Management Strategy, which has goals of building resilient landscapes, creating fire-adapted communities, and creating safe and effective kind of risk-based wildfire response efforts. And so, you know, there's resources out there, but the big question is, how do you reach people who might not have access to those resources? And, you know, one example in Utah that I recently learned about is HECHO, which is the Hispanics Enjoying Camping, Hunting in the Outdoors. And that's a really neat organization. And that's just one example where we could reach out as an educational entity and present kind of to-do lists that these communities can learn about and things they can take action on right around their own homes that can begin to mitigate this at a very local scale. And so I think that's part of the equation too.
That was Mitchell Power, Associate Professor of Geography at the University of Utah. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour, We'll be right back. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. Today, a panel discusses the increasing frequency and severity of wildfires in the western U.S. Here again is your moderator, Brenda Bowen.
All right. We have a question here from our audience about Indigenous fire management. Can you speak to Indigenous fire management and the use of good fire historically? And can any of those practices be incorporated into how we're looking at things now?
Well, I do know that we work very closely with the Bureau of Indian Affairs in a lot of our interagency work that we do. They participate, you know, in a lot of the things that we do as far as prescribed burning. They're not outside of the box when it comes to anything that we do. They participate with us. So, you know, for them to do really anything different, it's not really what we see here, at least in Utah or in the West. And so, you know, to speak to that, you know, they do the same things that we're doing, you know, with prescribed burning and all of the prevention stuff that we do here as well.
Any other insights into that from our panelists?
I'll just add to Brett that, you know, we often call this TEK, right? Traditional ecological knowledge. And it's really, I would say from a scientific perspective, it's an untapped resource. And we need to be better about incorporating that, not only to the science we do in universities, but how we communicate what we know and understand to the public. And it's beginning to happen, and it pops up more at conferences and workshops, and people know it's important. And I'm just really glad to hear Brett's, you know, kind of on the same page with the tribes of Utah. It's really neat to hear.
We've got another question from our audience here. What does a fire adapted community look like, and how are governments helping rural communities with resources to cope with fires? Yes, Brett.
So we have lots of programs in place to help communities harden themselves against fire. You know, a community that's done its work is one that could withstand a fire front that would be approaching that community. And so, you know, some of the things that we've done here in the state of Utah with our counties, as far as them participating more in what that looks like, you know, it used to be set up in the state of Utah that we would charge the counties for any fires that they had. We've gone away from that and told them, instead of paying the state back for what the suppression costs were, we want you to reinvest that money in your communities and harden them against fires approaching the communities, and do that work, and we'll partner with you to do that. And, you know, maybe we send people out there to say, you know, this is what you need to do, this is what you can do, and make those communities resilient so that when we do have a fire that approaches, it doesn't take a whole lot of action to make those homes defendable against that fire.
That's great. And it sounds like some of the resources that Mitch mentioned online are places where folks can learn more about sort of their local scale defenses and being prepared. And that actually, you mentioned that the counties used to have to pay, which leads into one of the other questions that we thought about, which is, you know, what is the economic toll of wildfires, and who pays that? Who's responsible for covering those costs? Yes, Brett.
So the last 5 years, our suppression costs, and I can only speak to the state because I have those numbers right here in front of me, but you know, it goes for the federal government as well. The last 5 years, our suppression costs have gone through the ceiling. You know, you can look back to 2016, our suppression costs in the state for all fires was about $10 million. And you look at that compared to last year, 2020, that went to $27 million. A lot of those costs are because of the WUI and what it's done. I mean, we have to spend a tremendous amount of money you know, trying to save those structures. And a lot of those costs come from aircraft. Anytime you see those big tankers coming and dropping the retardant, you're going to see those costs just go through the roof. And then that's where a lot of those costs come from, is trying to save, you know, what's in front of that fire. If we had, you know, these communities participating more and doing more of that work to reduce the fuels around those communities, we wouldn't have to expend that amount of money. But, you know, until that happens, until we can get the public to buy off on what we're trying to do and what we're trying to save, you're going to continue to see these costs go up. And ultimately, it's the taxpayers, it's us, the public, that pays for these costs. You know, whether that's a human start fire or whether that's a lightning start fire, it's us, the taxpayers, that are paying for it.
I think we can also think about some of the indirect costs and wonder if any of you might comment on that.
Just add a couple points. And it's, you know, one thing I think is really difficult to get a handle on is the kind of net value change that happens with a fire. And so if you think of costs in the broadest sense, we have ecological services. We get our clean air from forests. And so, you know, what's the cost there? It's not just the value of the timber, it's the loss of, you know, habitat, ecosystem service, you know, clean air, groundwater recharge, you know, all of those things are really difficult to bring into the equation of costs. And so, I did a little searching in the literature last week about this, and it's really hard to find comprehensive cost metrics. And I think they've done it a little bit in Florida. They've tried to do some work comparing hurricane costs to wildfire costs. And there was an interesting piece of work done back in 98 where it was an El Nino year, and Florida experienced a lot of wildfires, and they had something like $600 million in costs. I think the equivalence was a category 2 hurricane. So when you start to compare these extreme events to each other, it may be that, you know, wildfire costs, if you have other big extreme events, may not be that much relative to what else you might be facing. So, but again, you know, it's really difficult to measure all of the costs and benefits around these events. I just wanted to add that.
Yeah, definitely. And Kim?
I just had 2 quick thoughts. And, you know, when we talk about rural communities, a lot of them are dependent on tourism. And so they'll feel the loss of that as these wildfires expand, not just the direct impact of the wildfires, but the loss of tourism really impacts some of our rural communities. And then as we look at the health care costs, that's really shared across all of us as well as our healthcare costs rise. So I think they're just those are the 2 things I would add.
Yeah. All right, we've got several questions coming in from our audience. So let's go to some of those. Let's see, in Salt Lake County, so across our community, many homeowners are in unincorporated areas, for instance, in canyons, and they're prohibited from managing their brush and foliage growth around their homes. What can be done around that? So are there guidances on that? I'm not familiar with the policies around managing landscapes and sort of that wildland interface. Can anyone speak to that?
I'm not aware of what that policy is. I know Unified Fire Authority manages most of the unincorporated in Salt Lake County, and they have a fuels crew that helps reduce that load. And I know they're specifically working up some of those canyons, Little and Big Cottonwood Canyon. They do a lot of work up there to reduce fuel load around homes. You know, some of the stuff that we're working on and the WUI code, you know, it does specifically say in there that you've got to have vegetation removed from your home up to 30 feet. So I'm not sure what that policy is or what they're talking about, that they're not allowed to remove that vegetation around their homes. I mean, it's a state law that they have to, or at least try to.
So if somebody is wondering who to reach out to get more information or what to type into their Google search to learn about this, where would you direct them to learn about protecting their homes in that kind of environment?
The best thing to do is reach out to their local fire department and they can put them in contact with us. We have a WUI coordinator located in 6 area offices throughout the state that can come and help them with that. And, you know, the fire departments are directly connected to us. And so we'd be happy to come out and do an assessment and help them with that.
Excellent. Thank you for that.
That was Brett Osler, State Fire Management Officer at the Utah Division of Forestry, Fire, and State Lands. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. Once more, here is your moderator, Brenda Bowen.
All right. One of our other questions here is, how important are legacy forest management practices, such as snuffing out small fires, planting trees very close together, some of the things that were sort of practices of the past, and causing the fire crisis we're experiencing today? So maybe do we have better knowledge now of best management practices, or are those still best practices? Andrea.
I think we have a lot of examples, even just here in Utah, that show the vulnerability of forests due to earlier human activities and not necessarily management. One example that comes to mind was the deforestation of the Wasatch Plateau. When the early settlers came, they used all that spruce to, you know, build all their structures. When the forest grew back, it grew back essentially as a single-age forest, which, you know, is more vulnerable to all kinds of things. In this case, it was the spruce beetles that got in there. And, you know, I think it was like over 90% mortality of mature spruce. I think we see similar things with vulnerability to fire. In the Southwest, we have ponderosa pine forests where fire suppression has eliminated the ground fires that used to come through every 7 to 10 years. And it's, you know, the forests in many places have grown up with, you know, dogwood that gets really, you know, tiny trees close together as opposed to, you know, sort of the big, large, separated forests that were here before the American impact.
Yeah, definitely interesting to think about how big picture landscape changes have shaped where we are now. Mitch.
Yeah, just to add on to Andrea's comments, I think what we can all appreciate in Utah is we have the compression of different ecological spaces because of elevation. And so we go from grassland, shrubland down around Salt Lake Valley to alpine forest very quickly at the top of the Wasatch. And those are very different fire systems. And so there's a complex geography to this kind of legacy question. And in my mind, from some of my research, the high elevation, the spruce and the fir forests, those don't burn historically, but once every 200, 300, or 400 years. So they have very long kind of time spans between fires. And when they burn at this kind of crown fire, very severe, and then they regrow. But down in these low elevations, fire needs to happen. Species are adapted to this. Our oak woodlands here around the university, they quickly resprout from roots when they burn. So it's completely fire adapted system. And, you know, our best estimates are 30 to 50 years for those to burn. And so, you know, that's a big difference between a few decades to a few centuries in just, you know, a few miles of elevational space. So I think our topography complicates some of the legacy part of the system in terms of, you know, how do we apply fire? Where has, like Andrew mentioned, where have these cohorts, these even age stands popped up? Because the best resilience, what we've learned is age complexity, have patches of meadow next to older trees, and that will change the behavior of a fire as it comes into a system.
And I wonder how we manage wildlands on that scale, right, down to the structure of the ecosystem. That's really, would be quite a interagency task, I imagine. It's interesting to hear from each of you sort of from your research perspectives versus, you know, working for the state and different agencies who are looking at some of the impacts. But something I I see that spans all of these is really our changing technology around addressing fires. I've been struck just looking at social media, these satellite images of the fires in the West that are creating the smoke plume that we all are experiencing right now. And wondering how your work and your agencies or your research are using different technologies to do work on fire right now. Are you drawing on satellite imagery or looking at sort of the latest NOAA stuff? And that's other people's work, I guess.
we've actually started planning some drone campaigns, because with the use of drones now, you can do small scale kind of satellite type imagery and mapping. And part of this is related to the drought. And what we're seeing in some of our Great Basin mountain ranges is high juniper mortality at the lower edges of the juniper woodlands. And so one idea is to try to capture that now as it's happening, to get a handle on the geography of it, the spatial extent, as well as the rate, and how quickly are we losing some of these lower juniper woodlands. And so I think drone technology is pretty neat for some of those applications. And Andrew and I have a colleague in our department who's much more well-versed in this technology. She's graciously agreed to allow us to play with some of those toys. So I think there's some opportunity there.
Is this state using drones and that sort of technology to map out active fires and seeing where some of these sort of more homogeneous stands of trees and things are as well?
Yeah, not only the state, but our federal partners, we've been using drones for the last several years and using them in different methods, whether it's, mapping out some of these forests and where we might be able to go in and do some reduction of fuel loading. And we've been using them for fires to map those out, and also using them for thermal imaging, looking for some of the heat pockets and stuff in there. So yeah, drones have definitely been used for the last, several years.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. I'm thinking about for some of our participants, if you're students here at the University of Utah or elsewhere, and thinking about, training that you might be interested in to be someone to out, be working on some of these fire issues. There's a lot of different angles to come at it from, and certainly learning to do that kind of data analysis and acquisition seems like a really valuable tool. And Kim, on the UCARE front, I know I'm always now on my Utah Air apps and looking at different, Purple Air and all of the different places I can get real-time air quality data. So certainly that data collection is a big part of what you guys are doing as well.
Yeah, and so I would just mention two resources. This is not new technology, but one of the places that I like to go for a lot of information is fire.airnow.gov, and you can really track the fires and see where they're coming and what the wind patterns will be. I'm an air quality nerd, and so I like to see that, but also it's good for the general population to know. And then as we look at air quality in general, you can go to ucare.org, and we have all of those air quality indexes available there. We pull from the state resources. The Division of Air Quality is really our partner that is all the data and metrics behind what we do. And so I would direct people to go there. It's really important that people understand that as the air quality index goes up and we see some of these, what the state calls mandatory action days, there are things that you can do to help reduce your emissions and be part of the solution. And one of those things would be, for instance, teleworking on a poor air quality day when it's been forecasted. And that not only helps with our air quality issues, but it helps with your health and some of those issues as well. We always, mention some of the big ones, which are be idle free, drive less, carpool, make sure that you're taking public transit if it's a poor air quality day, and some of those things. But really remembering that with the wildfires, the air has been so bad that it's not just our vulnerable populations that have been impacted by it, but really all of us. And so from a health perspective, just remember to be tracking the air quality and be aware of it.
Definitely. Thank you. And thanks for pointing us towards those resources. So in my role as Mitch and Andrea know, being the director of the Global Change and Sustainability Center, I'm really interested in issues that really demand collaboration across disciplines. And it seems like this is clearly one of these cases where not only across agencies and sectors, but, you know, from ecologists to land managers to air quality, you know, atmospheric scientists, environmental scientists, technology development with engineering, policy, you know, right? This is one of those examples of people needing to come together. And I'm wondering if in the work that you do, do you see examples of folks really coming together across sectors and across departments to talk about fire and to talk about how to move forward? Yes, Andrea.
In the last decade or so, I've definitely worked more with land management agencies and been trying to cater what I can get from these, you know, long-term sedimentary records into something that's actually useful. So I think that there is, at least between, you know, some of the science folks and managers, is, you know, I think a lot of us that are doing research really want what we're producing to be of use and applicable and helpful.
Definitely. Are there any other examples you guys can share?
I'll just add a recent piece of work that Andrea and I have been involved in, and that's been kind of working with folks out of the anthropology department here at the University of Utah, and really trying to explore some of this traditional ecological knowledge and use of fire, and how our long-term thousand-year records of fire can integrate some of the archaeology and anthropology that we understand from the West to get a better idea of, you know, maybe there's lessons in there for how we manage and interact with fire today. But I think you're absolutely right, Brenda, in that we really do need these diverse teams to solve these complex problems. And there's incentive now. I think funding agencies recognize this, and they want to see this these kinds of proposals presented to bring together different groups. And we've done it here, I think, extraordinarily well. You've been the champion of this at the university. So kudos to you as well.
Thanks. Thinking also more about what we're doing at the university right now. It was mentioned I get to be the co-chair of our Presidential Climate Commitment Task Force right now with Carrie Case, our university's chief sustainability officer. And one of our main activities over the last year has been conducting the university's first climate resilience assessment, where we tried to come up with sort of a baseline of what are our climate related vulnerabilities at the university and within our community? What are our strengths or assets that we have in place that might help us, you know, address some of those vulnerabilities, and really trying to identify what are indicators of resilience, right? We use this word resilience a lot, but how do we know when we're resilient? So what are those specific indicators of resilience, and where are we now? What are our metrics? And we just recently posted that. If folks are interested, it's on the Sustainability Office's website. But it's now creates this space where we can say, well, what are our goals? Where should we be? And how do we get there? And that's where we're going to be going in this coming year with a new climate action plan that we'll be embarking on in the coming year. But as we think about resilience of the university and within our communities and this issue around fire, how do we build more resilient communities given these changes to wildfire that we're experiencing? And how do we particularly help vulnerable populations throughout all this work around climate resilience and climate action? We're trying to come at it through an equity lens and really make sure we're addressing some of the vulnerable issues. So really, how can the University of Utah help be a part of this work towards building more resilient communities? What do you guys think about that? Ideas about how we strengthen our resilience, or what resilience might look like for the university around fire? So what would make us resilient? Yeah, Brett.
So I think one thing, you know, I think we've got our Fire Sense campaign going on, and I think the university could assist us in helping change culture in all of Utah. You know, we've got to take this approach of how we've got to change human culture in the way that we look at prevention. That's one of the things that we've really hit hard with on this campaign is, you know, we've got to look at how we change the way we recreate, the way we, you know, work. And, you know, we've got the way the climate change is happening. We're working more often in high fire danger times and, you know, just, you know, everyday work that we do. And we're starting to see a lot of human start fires based on what we're doing. And I think we've got to get the word out to, you know, maybe first year students of, you know, what we can do to change our behavior when it comes to prevention and wildfire in the state of Utah and the surrounding states for that matter as well.
Great. Thanks. I think having panels like this is a start of that culture shift, just awareness, helping people have the conversations and know what questions to ask. Other thoughts about what resilience might look like and how we build more resilient communities?
I would just mention that we work really closely with Carrie Kelly, who's at the University of Utah. She's on our board, actually, and she's one of the leading researchers on air quality issues in the state. And I feel like the university is really leading the conversation on improving air quality. And that's a great thing that the U has done is just the research behind and the, you know, data and metrics and understanding the issues. It's really cross-disciplinary and, you know, we have air quality and wildfire, it's all related. And so I would just say that you guys are doing a good job on the research front.
Thank you. I'm curious from Mitch and Andrea, where do you think if we wanted to expand and grow and strengthen our research focus in this area to be, you know, of even more service to the state and the nation and the world around these issues, where could we grow and extend our fire research contribution?
I was hoping Andrea would jump in first. It's a tough question. You know, and I think everything starts with really good communication. And so you have to bring stakeholders together in some kind of dialogue to begin communication. And we've all seen enough divisiveness over the last several years that I think something like wildfires in the West, we can all talk about and share similar concerns and desires for outcomes. So I think bringing agencies and stakeholders and private citizens, as well as big commercial entities, bringing those folks together to identify, you know, some of these key things, like, you know, what are the community values most at risk? So if there's a fire coming and you have to save something, what would that priority be? And getting those ideas out, creating community plans and how you might go about, protecting some of these high mark values allows people to share, you know, what they think is most important. And, you know, it's a long road to bring those dialogues together. But I think, as Brett has said, we're constantly in response mode, not in planning or kind of preparing mode for something, you know, 2, 3, 5 years down the road. And so that's the other cultural shift that needs to happen is how do we take a little bit longer view and not just respond to a bad air quality day, but think about next summer and how we'd like to have less of those bad air quality days. And that's difficult business to do.
Thanks, Mitch. Andrea.
I was just going to say to continue conducting more interdisciplinary research. So physical scientists, ecological scientists, working more with social scientists and land managers and trying to, you know, design research questions and outcomes that can be useful in developing these resilient communities.
Definitely agree with that. So there's one more question from our audience that I think we have time for, and we can see where we get. There's actually several more questions, but I'll ask the one that's here, which is, are there any policies that you would like to see past or that you think could help with combating wildfires. So if you, you know, could maybe wave a magic wand and set a new policy that might make a big difference, what might that be? Who's having ideas there?
Now I'll just throw out there the funding challenge, and that as Brett touched on, the funding for fire suppression and trying to control wildfires far outpaces any kind of community level adaptation or strategic planning. And so if we could create a policy that would bring up the level of funding for more of the kind of proactive things that we need to do for prevention versus putting most of the money into the response, I think that would be a really neat first step.
Others, any policies you either see on the horizon or think might make a difference?
I guess I would just say that I think it's really interesting to hear what Brett said earlier about the decrease in human-caused fires due to public education. I think we've seen the governor and a lot of our legislators lead out on that issue this year. We need to see more of that and just make sure that we're educating people on what their role is related to that, related to wildfires.
Great, thanks. Yeah, Andrea.
I just had a question for Brett, having just seen the Parley's Canyon fire, knowing that that one was human caused, do you think that there's anything that could have been done to prevent that? I mean, you can't foresee all the potential, you know, broken axles or catalytic converters or whatever, but I wonder, like, is there a way to create bigger buffers along roadways when fire season or when fire risk is really high?
So I got two answers. One, we are working with UDOT quite a bit to make sure that they're mowing, they typically mow their right-of-ways a little bit. Most of that is for snow removal in the winter. But, you know, one of the things that we've addressed with them is they need to start mowing a little bit more, you know, go, we said fence to fence, take that out a little bit more, get rid of that vegetation, give it a little more time to burn before it gets into the higher vegetation and a fire department gets there. One of the other things that we're looking at as well, and this wouldn't have happened with this one, maybe it would, maybe it wouldn't, is we've gone away from doing vehicle inspections a number of years ago. And maybe if this car, this vehicle would have been up on the rack in an inspection mode, you know, maybe that would have been caught that this vehicle had a bad catalytic converter. You know, some of that stuff's checked, some of it's not. I think maybe we need to go back to having some vehicle inspections done, because the number of human caused fires that are started from vehicles going down the road is tremendous. And, you know, a lot of people, if someone doesn't tell them they've got a bad tire, they don't look at it until it's too late. So, you know, I think, you know, some of that stuff we need to take a look at as well.
That was Brett Osler, State Fire Management Officer at the Utah Division of Forestry, Fire, and State Lands. This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Anthony Scoma, your producer and host of this program. As always, thanks for listening.